session number 24825, Reel 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Arthur Leggett in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 3rd of the 2nd, 2003, at the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Arthur, we've been talking about, obviously, the situation with you putting on Cinderella, and I was interested to find out how putting on such a play sort of took your mind off the realities that you were in.
I doubt if there was any real escape from the reality of where we were, but the idea was to, the opportunity was there, and we felt that a Christmas pantomime would keep the boys in good spirits, because at this stage I'm talking of, we had been locked up for about 4 years. This sort of thing, an entertainments committee kept the troops together, and it kept up their morale, put it that way. But as regards the progress of the war, we were isolated. We were up in the Polish, over the Polish border, working in coal mines. There was about 300 to 400 of us in one camp, and we had no contact with other camps or prisoners of war outside that camp, except perchance when some men went to a dentist and they met men from other camps then. The only information that we really had from the war was what the Germans gave us through in their propaganda routine. We had a newspaper published by the Germans called The Camp, in which they gave us all the information they wanted us to have. And one which surprised us immensely was discussing North Africa. They derided the advance of the British troops because the advance of the British forward troops was so slow, on several occasions they lost contact with the German rear guard. Now, in our language, that means someone was retreating in a bloody hurry, and this caused us quite a bit of amusement. That is just one incident where our newspaper that they published kept us informed of the war as they wanted it to be seen. I can't really say a great deal else other than that, except repeat, we were isolated and we only got news which we wanted and what we could garnish here and there around the mine underground.
What can you tell us of the conditions of the mine underground?
I had never been underground before, and it amazed me. We got into a skip or lift, and it was as big as the average lift in the retail stores. Goodness knows how far down we went. I understand it was about 1,000 feet. And we got out into a platform, and there was a tunnel there with a diameter of at least 20 feet across, and it was cement-lined rails going through it. And once we were sorted out as to where we were going, we were taken down these tunnels, and eventually we reached the area where the coal was, and I had never seen so much coal. My knowledge of coal mining came from D.H. Lawrence, where there was little seams running around here and there and blokes crawling around on their hands and knees all day. But this was immense. They would sink a slope downwards, say 20 feet in diameter, drag all the coal out of it. Then they'd put in another one a bit further along, same thing. And then they would block them up and fill them with sand and then take out what was between. And when that was done, they'd elevate the whole thing, and what was the ceiling of the previous shaft was now the floor of the one you were working on. Some of these shafts would be several hundred metres long, and they would have a a conveyor belt right along the length of this tunnel, and they would blow the face down, which was parallel to the conveyor belt, and the job was to shovel coal onto this conveyor belt, which conveyed it out to trucks, two-ton trucks they held, where they were hauled out and eventually arrived at the surface. The first few weeks we were taken down there, and there was a German ship boss. It seems to me the Poles were the workers, the Germans were the ship bosses, and he ranted and raved up and down this conveyor belt, demanding more effort, more effort. And after about 6 weeks, the job that I had, thanks to the Red Cross and bribery and skullduggery, I used to go down the mine, and there used to be an electric motor with two buttons on the wall, one for start, one for stop. When the shift started, I would press the one for start, and when it finished, I'd press the one for stop, and that was my day's work, thanks to chocolate and soap and a few cigarettes, and this sort of thing paid off quite well. And the war itself, the first we knew of the invasion, we were in the skip about to go down, when a German, whom we'd never seen before, but he's obviously a man of education, he just stepped in and said, "The invasion has begun. We will now find out who is going to win." And he stepped outside the skip again. And that's when we knew that the 6th of June had arrived.
D-Day.
D-Day, yeah.
What were the feelings then that you felt that?
Well, I won't say elation, because we had the Empire had suffered quite a lot of defeats in its day, and we were soldiers. You don't take anything for granted, but we certainly look forward to the future news which may perchance come our way and help us get some idea what was going on.
The Germans obviously were to fight on for a long time. It wouldn't be until almost a year later.
Mm.
In what way did you have to sort of change your attitude in and around the camp, knowing that something was going on?
Well, it's a funny thing. We had been with these guards now for over 2 years, and we knew them all by their Christian names, and we spoke to them. They were guards, we were prisoners, but more or less soldiers in general. And if there was any discussion, there was no real animosity about it at all. But I can't clearly recollect any open discussion about the situation of the war with the Germans, or any change in the attitudes of the men generally, because it may sound a little bit boastful, but morale was always high. We never for 1 minute doubted that we were going to win the war.
Lose the war?
No, we never doubted we would win. We were going to win.
Okay.
And so that was always in our mind. And once the invasion started, well, we thought, well, it won't be long now. It was just like that. The a few points there which we'll relate later. The place that printed our paper money, our POW money, had got bombed out. I may have mentioned this. And we were then paid in German francs, or German marks, rather. And we used to charge the fellows 5 marks to come and see our shows. And we could get from that, we could give this to the camp administration, and they in turn could hire costumes from the local town to assist us in our productions. So, do you want me to go on from here? Right. One day, we came up out of the mine, and the South African Sergeant Major, who was the chief of our particular camp, said, "There's no work tomorrow, we're moving out." And we couldn't believe this, because we were moving out. Well, that night, or about 3 o'clock, I suppose, someone said, "Then, do you hear that thunder?" Well, it was midwinter, and you don't get thunder in midwinter there. But there was more of it for a couple of nights, I should say. we had been hearing this, because then it dawned on us that they were guns, and the front must be moving pretty close to where we were, because that is what had happened. The Russians were on their big advance across Europe, and we were in the road. So the
what was the feeling like knowing that the Russians were getting close?
Well, some fellas. Well, wait a minute. I'll try and do this logically. We were okay. We had gear which we wanted to carry. Of course, we all had precious possessions and so on, which we gradually got together and minimised, threw a lot out. We made bobsleds to carry these things. The Germans had a numerous stools in each room for the men to sit on. They had like a section of steamed timber which had been shaped like a U. So you cut these at the top of the U, and this gave you two runners for a sledge. And from that you built a box, and then you put your gear in that. And we were heavily clothed, of course, it was midwinter. And they marched us out the gate. And away we went, and for the next 3 months we marched over 750 kilometres right across Silesia, down through the Czechoslovakian Alps, all the way back into Bavaria in midwinter. We're just a few days, well, I don't know how far ahead of the Russians we were, but there was no rations, there was no food, it was only what we could scrounge along the road. What Red Cross food we had, of course, that eventually all got consumed. You still had the mucker system going, where you had a mate, which you called your mucker, and you shared everything that you got with him. In this way, we strung our Red Cross food out for a while. But the food, at the end of a day, we were usually put into big barns. It seems to me that where farms joined, they built their farmhouse, and they had a communal barn, which is big, and we were just put in there for the night. You would take your boots off, pour the water out, because snow is everywhere. The loose snow would hang onto your boot. The warmth of your feet would melt it. It would saturate your boot and your sock, and you'd plod on all day. At the end of the day, before you went to sleep, you'd bury it in the straw underneath you to try and keep it warm. But comes the dawn, then your boot would have an eighth of an inch of ice inside it to start the day off. Your socks would be ice-bound. You'd have to crunch them up to get them on your feet, and that's how you would start the day off. There would probably be no breakfast, there'd be no lunch. And at the end of the day, if the local farming community were adaptable, they would give you a few cabbages and turnips and stuff to chop up and try and make some sort of a stew. You'd finish up with a hot drink, I suppose, noted more for its volume than its quality. And that's how we lived for quite some time. We marched all the way because we all lost weight. We were all suffering from malnutrition and so on. Getting back to the money we charged for the entrance to our entertainment, the secretary said, well, look, we've got a big roll of this, we should split it or hand it all back to the men. And being an Australian, I said, no, we'll split it in half and we'll buy something for the boys along the road. But of course, there was nothing for the boys along the road. So I had this big roll of German marks in my pocket all the time, unable to do anything with it. Eventually, we were in a big barn. We had to have, turn it off for a second. Well, I mentioned the marks because they come into the story later on. They didn't play very much at this particular stage of our existence.
In relation to the march, how were you keeping yourselves going? Why didn't you just sort of sneak off and wait for the Russians to catch you up?
Some fellas did. Well, I think you have met up with Bluey Heron. He shot through, and he was liberated by the Russians. He finished up going down through Odessa, around the Black Sea, and back into Egypt that way, and eventually finished up. But As we started off as guards and prisoners of war, we finished up as a conglomeration of human beings, just plodding day after day after day for no set purpose. There were times when you feel that you couldn't go another step, and then in the gutter beside the country road where you are, there'd be a couple of political prisoners with a neat hole drilled through their forehead, so you thought, well, maybe I can go on a bit further than this. And you struggled on eventually, just from day to day. There were little incidents in it. My offside, my mucker, he had a violin in a wooden case. I followed this violin on his back right across Europe, and I was sick of the sight of this damn thing. But there it was, he had a violin, he wasn't going to let it go. And he had it with him. In fact, he had it after the war for years. Another fellow on his back, he had on his pack, on his outside his pack, he had an enamel bedchamber, which he boiled and boiled and boiled until it was his idea of sterilised, and that was his cooking pot from there onwards. And I understand that was brought back to Australia too and played a prominent part until his wife made it into a flower pot and then it vanished. And these are little things. We did have a bit of a train ride at one stage where we finished up close to Regensburg down in Bavaria, and in that area there, at a place called Overtraubling, a little village, the Red Cross caught up with us there. But prior to this, we had been in a barn with a small yard beside it, a cow yard we'd call it, and beside that was the village church with a clock that struck every quarter hour and bonged out every quarter hour. Nearby were some mounds under the snow, which we worked out must have been potatoes under those mounds. And we made our way through the end of the barn and we rifled these things. But next morning all hell broke loose. The farmer realised that someone had got into his seed potatoes and he had no seed to plant for the next year. But if he put a wagon in the barn and we filled that wagon up, he'd say no more about it. So this was done. Then the military took over, because it was obvious that there had been a guard on that particular door of the barn, so some guard had let the boys through. Well, this had been done, probably a few cigarettes had swapped hands, and the guard too, one of the boys more or less then, they wanted to know who it was, and we were not telling. So at the end of that day, when we were back in the barn, they dragged us all out, sawed us all out, lined us up in this cow yard and wanted to know who the guard was. Well, we weren't telling, so they said, well, you'll stand there until you tell us. So we stood there all night. All through the night it snowed, the snow under your feet. You couldn't get out of your line. Those were the orders. Any man that stepped out of line was going to be shot, but of course the boys then had to go to the toilet, didn't they? So there was a constant flow of movement to the toilet. Comes the next day, the local colonel who was in charge of the guards in the district just shook his head and said, basically in German, you bloody Australians are mad, and he dismissed us all, and that was the end of it. So, but you could see he appreciated that we were all soldiers and we weren't going to dob another bloke in, and it done us a good turn. At this camp, we used to go daily into Regensburg to clean up the bomb damage. The bomb damage was something atrocious. The town had just about been wiped out. A little train used to take us into Regensburg from Overtraubling, and between our barn and Regensburg was a big marshalling yard. We were on our way home in the train one day, and we were between Regensburg and the marshalling yard when the bombers came over from the far side of the town, and they're just doing carpet bombing. They went right through the town, and then they were still coming our way, and we thought this must be it. We couldn't see how we were going to get out of this. We see the bombs leave the plane, and they passed right overhead, and they went right through the marshalling yard, and we were in between. I mean, another 10 minutes, and we would have been in the marshalling yard. That was another episode there.
Being in a situation where you'd seen the might of the Allies, how was that affecting?
Yes, you have a point there. Let me enlarge on it. We were, had been marching for over three months. We were starved. We were suffering from malnutrition. We were suffering from dirt. You know, our clothes hadn't been changed. We hadn't had a bath. We hadn't been able to really shave, clean ourselves up. And then suddenly you'd see a Lightning fighter come over, these twin fuselage planes. We'd never seen planes move so fast. They'd light onto a train and they'd swoop across and smash the engine so that it couldn't be moved again. That was the end of that engine as far as the Fatherland was concerned. These goods trains also had anti-aircraft guns mounted on them, and they'd swoop up and come back and have a go at the anti-aircraft guns. And this was an amazing thing to us because we had been on the negative side for so long, and here were blokes with a positive attitude. That was a phenomenal uplift. And then also there were days when we were in, not in the road, were in the, well, we were in areas over which flying fortresses flew, and when I say flying fortresses, they stretched from one horizon to the other, left and right and fore and aft. We had never seen so many planes. There must have been 1,000 four-engine bombers. Well, the biggest thing we had seen had been a twin-engine Blenheim bomber up till this stage, and the ground shook. We couldn't believe what we were seeing and feeling as these planes passed overhead on their raids. It was truly a really uplifting sight. And
what are the guards, how did they view
They knew the war was lost and there wasn't much they could do about it. And even on the final day, we were from over travelling, we were marched for a few more days. Then we were in a barn, a big barn. It was down in a bit of a valley. There's a road going up along the top of this valley. And the guard commander said, "We are going to leave you here. Now stay in this barn for a few days because the troops coming back are not very nice people and they could set fire to the barn if they wanted to." And he warned us about this. So we sat there for a few days, and after about the third day, things were very quiet. German guards, German soldiers were retreating back through this area, but it was not an organised retreat. They were scampering in singles and twos and threes, and they were just on a rout. That's all there was about it. So there was no mass of German soldiers retreating in an orderly manner. One day, one of the fellows said, "There's a lot of tanks going to buy up the top of the road." He says, "They're all Russian. They've all got stars on them." And another bloke sings out, "Well, what colour's the stars?" He said, "Oh, they're all white." "Oh," he says, "bloody Yanks, we're free." So again, this South African sergeant major said, "Now sit here for a while, boys, don't start doing anything stupid." So we sat there for a while, and eventually down a road from the top, there's three jeeps come down loaded with GIs. They pulled up, one pulled up in front of the barn, one went left, one went right. The blokes fanned out with Tommy guns and everything, and they advanced to the barn, and the bloke threw open the doors and looks around and said, "Okay, you guys, you're all free." Well, there was no loud cheering and screaming. Quiet voices there. "Oh, where you been? We've been waiting for you." And he looked around and said, "Oh, bloody Australians." And he said, "Well, we had a bit of trouble getting here." "Oh, we forgave him anyway." So he just waved to all his blokes, and he just said, "Well, just be careful, there's still a few Germans around the area." He said, "Don't go wandering around too much." And there we were. We just sat there for a while thinking about this, and then gradually we walked out of the barn and walked around. It was a remarkable feeling. There was no guards, nothing. We were free.
That was it?
That's how we were liberated, yeah. Simple as that. And,
after all that time, after everything you've been through in relation to being prisoner of war camp, the marching, the working in coal mines, how did you cope with the fact that you were now free?
We sat down and could think about it for a while. In fact, we hung around the barn for a day or so after that. And I think, too, it's because we had been relying on each other for so many years for support that we're a bit reluctant to disperse. And in due course, a mate and I and a few others, we did sit around the barn for a few days, and then a couple of Americans come down one day and said, "Is anyone here can speak German?" Well, I said, I've got a bit of an idea. He said, "Can you give us a hand down this village?" He said, "We're having a bit of trouble down there." So I said to me, "Mate, you going to come down with me?" He said, "No." He said, "There's a farmhouse over there. I'll see if I can scrounge a bit of food." So I go down to this village with the Germans, with the Americans, and there's a fellow there said, "Look, all I want you to do is explain to this bloke who seems to be the boss in the village, we're not going to burn it, and we're not going to rape all the women, we just want to set up a signal station in the school." Oh, that was all right, so that was all organised. And the American said, "Well, look, here, take these, mate." And he gave me about 6 packets of K rations, and they're all labelled breakfast units. He said, "We haven't got anything else but breakfast units." So that was all right. It was food. I wasn't going to argue. I get back to the barn. I said, "Anyone seen me, mate?" "Yes." One bloke says, "Yeah, I think I saw him go around behind the barn somewhere." And I go around behind the barn. Snow was still on the ground. There's 2 feet going over a little hillock. So I follow these feet up. And there, in a little hollow, there's a fire going, built on a couple of rocks, Australian style. There's a billy can on it, and there's 2 chooks boiling in this billy can, and my mate's sitting there on another rock playing his violin. And so I go over to him. We'd never had an argument before. And I said, "Look, but I got food, mate." He said, "Here we are, here's our dinner." Because he said, "Look, they're bloody breakfast units. Now, there's dinner in the pot." That was that. So we had greasy chook for dinner, and without salt and vegetables, and we had the K rations for tea. So we.
What are things like celebration?
No, there was no celebration. I wouldn't say. No, we all had an uplifting feeling, of course. So you were, that's obvious. But mainly, we're thinking about how we were going to get home and so on. And there was no real organisation immediately adjacent to direct us anywhere in particular. So half a dozen of us set off, or it might have been a bit more than that, set off to walk on. Yeah, the Americans told us, "Get up to Regensburg. They're flying you out from there." So we set off towards Regensburg. We got to a village one night, and we had Red Cross food. Oh, there's a point I forgot to tell you. During our stay at Overtravelling, the Swiss Red Cross trucks come through and found us there and gave us Red Cross food again. So we had Red Cross parcels again, which meant a bit of food and a bit of uplifting generally. We get into this village at the end of the day, and there is a tea rooms there. And of course, we go into the tea rooms, and we didn't realise it now. We had been in our uniforms for 3 months. We looked down and out, we were drawn, we were underweight, we were undernourished, and the 2 ladies in this tea room were dead sure they were going to be raped, for sure as hell. But when we discussed the food we had and could they cook it for us, oh, no trouble at all. And when we told them to have a feed with us, they couldn't believe it, especially when I gave them a few marks for their services. And we slept on the floor of their tea rooms that night out of the cold. Next day in the local village, a tractor came in, a farmer came in with a couple of wagons behind his tractor, loaded up with Germans who were giving themselves up. So the Americans took over the German prisoners, and we took over the farmer's tractor, and we got in these wagons and we headed for Regensburg.